You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Place Invaders by Justin Heckert, with illustrations by Quick Honey. For Jason Broussard, games were life, a thriving business and a transportive hobby, one he'd manifested into a famed private collection, until the night he got gamed. Opening illustration shows the store with the door open, plate glass window broken, and a pickup truck outside, containing the store's safe. He tries his best to forget about the safe, but when he has a few free minutes and is cleaning the pins of old Nintendo cartridges with rubbing alcohol and Q-tips, a little piece of him dies every time he thinks about how he could have been so naive. When he ran the place, he would man the counter from a swivel chair next to the cash register, a can of Diet Coke by the keyboard of his desktop computer, his palms at the edge of a Super Mario World mouse pad. He'd lined his shelves with Pokemon and Pac-Man figurines, Sonic the Hedgehog plushies, T-shirts and stickers with the store's logo, dog-eared stacks of GamePro and Nintendo Power, and a feng shui of other games. Drawers nested all sorts of controllers smothered in black cords, until he was forced to sully the store by putting jail bars on the windows and installing security cameras out front. Trade and games had been lighthearted in spirit and charming in its accentuations. He'd wanted customers to experience what it had been like to be part of the video game generation that had discovered Nintendo and Sega. He had wished to replicate for people that feeling that usually disappears as they settle into adulthood. There's a Great Buys bargain bin and a giant glass collector's case. A placard above the employee gate by the desk reads, "Nintendo repair available here." The As Seen on YouTube sign he'd taken down. He'd had a kind of philanthropic hubris as an owner and collector, someone who never gave a second thought to keeping his legendary game collection a secret. He'd gladly let YouTubers film in the back. He would even open the safe back there and show them item by item his Louvre. Other collectors had rare games, sure, but in the back room of his store, and especially in the safe, he was proud to own 10,000 of what he described as cherry copies, his preferred term for virgin condition. The cardboard on his Super Nintendo games was still crispy, as collectors like to say. His Sega Genesis and Master System games were as pristine in their clamshells as if they had been hanging from the racks at KB Toys. Nothing about the store's appearance alluded to the miracle of his collection. It was just a single-story former laundromat with a workaday sign. He'd had the idea to paint Mario and Luigi so big anyone could see them from the main road, beyond the parking lot in an antiquated strip mall, the die-hard salon on one side and Murphy's Good Eats diner on the other. Trade and games, this pixelated utopia in a suburb of St. Louis, had turned out exactly how he'd imagined it more than 20 years ago. The exception to his vision took the form of the scarred tracks of dolly wheels leading from the back of the store across the blue carpet. Crushed into permanence by a 700-pound safe, dragged out the door in the middle of the night. Next illustration shows Pac-Man, Jason Broussard, who has spent his life amassing a collection of rare video games. Jason Broussard was racing 100 miles per hour to Trade and Games around 4:30 in the morning on August 16, 2019, a .38 caliber pistol by the cup holder in his truck. The trip was 3 miles from his condo in High Ridge, a commute that usually allowed an opportunity for his thoughts to drift, work with video games never being something to cause him stress. But he was terrified now, his hand pressed into the car horn to warn other drivers to stay away. A phone call had startled him awake, the Jefferson County Alarm Company telling him the front door of the store was open. He knew he would beat the police there. And he knew it'd be the newer games. He could feel it, straight through 3 consecutive red lights, barely easing off the pedal. It'd be the games arranged on the most prominent rows inside the store. They take the PlayStation 4s and the used Nintendo Switch consoles, and popular games like Skyrim, Dragons vs. Glitches 2016, like Breath of the Wild, Link of Zelda fame versus his own sense of curiosity, 2017, and Mario Kart 8, Go-Karts versus Go-Karts, 2014. Who would want to take anything else? He had an insurance policy, and he kept the register open and empty at night. And though the value of retro games had exploded in the past few years, he'd never been concerned about the safety of the thousands of games from his legendary collection, some of the most valuable video games on Earth. He'd kept this museum of his own making behind a metal vault door taped over with a Samus Aran poster from Metroid, Intergalactic Bounty Hunter vs. Pirates, 1986 to 2021. The contents of the vault and the safe within it had made him famous to certain collectors who would geek out about him and want to see those YouTube video tours of everything he had. Games like Air Raid, Save the City from Aliens, 1982, and Little Samson, Impish Warrior vs. World, 1992, and The Amazing Spider-Man, Web of Fire, Guy You Know vs. Terrorist, 1996, on the 32X, pieces of what he considered history that collectors might describe as grails. Though the vault door didn't work then and was mainly for show, that anything behind it could be, would be, stolen seemed unimaginable. Generations of games had been lost to attics, yard sales, and garbage bins, and enthusiasts like Broussard had become sentimental about finding and possessing them. A culture and then a market had bloomed around such wistful longings. It's fair to assume most humans have played a video game. The emotional capital of playing and loving a game 30 years ago is one of the reasons games that old have become desirable. In the summer of 2021, a sealed copy of the first print of Super Mario Bros. For the NES sold for $2 million at auction. A copy of The Legend of Zelda went for nearly $900,000. A pristine, never-opened copy of Super Mario 64 sold for $1.56 million. People started buying pieces of games, shares of them, 1/100th of a title as an investment. The zone is much less like the techno-hype surrounding NFTs. Christie sold one of those last year for $69 million, and far more akin to fine art. But Broussard's collection was, in its own way, deeply non-fungible. When you look at Super Mario Bros., you can say, "Man, I sunk 200 hours into this game as a kid," says Chris Kohler, longtime game journalist and author, and now editorial director at Digital Eclipse, a game developer. Look at The Legend of Zelda. To people, emotionally, that's a whole world that they escaped to. You can have really deep emotional connections to stuff like this. That was Broussard. He could see the store as he came down the hill of Gravois Road, the faded bricks, Mario and Luigi and the large Goomba sticker. The door was open. He parked the truck perpendicular to the front window, leaving the headlights shining into the store. A kickrest held the door in place. His work dolly, he noticed, was on the concrete, its wheels flattened and its metal arms bent. 2 gouges in the asphalt, from where it was pulled out of the store, raked several feet, and then discarded. The front window was broken, a cinder block marooned on the carpet inside. He got out of the truck, waving his gun, and yelled, "Police!" the word echoing as he crossed the doorway, his shoes crunching on the glass. No one was in the store. The shelves looked fine. The collector's case was locked, and the contents still looked neatly arranged, priced to sell. The cash register was on the floor, though, and the dolly tracks went all the way to the vault door and into the back. The shelves seemed undisturbed, but his work desk was pushed aside, papers and documents strewn. There were unfamiliar tools on the desk, someone else's. It took him a moment to process an empty space by the wall, to figure out what the crowbar would have been used for, or what someone had tried unsuccessfully to use it for, before they hauled off the safe anyway, still locked. The contents of that safe had taken him nearly 30 years to acquire, a few titles only a handful of people had ever seen. The safe itself he'd bought second-hand from a local real estate agent who was going out of business. Inside the safe, he had 120 games on three shelves, along with $19,000 in silver coins and bars and $10,000 in cash. He would only be able to claim around $100,000 as the value of the stolen games because the insurance adjuster would only use comparison prices from other sales. Hardly any of the games in the safe ever came up for sale in the decades he'd been collecting. The reality had him choking out tears into the dark. Every single game that was in the safe was very deliberate, Broussard says. I had the ultimate copies of those games. I had really sought them out over the years. They were in there for a reason. I identified with those games, like, people know Jason owns those games that no one else has. And I shared them. I had archived them, preserved them. It felt, he said, like a tragedy for the video game community, more than anything. How would he explain his hobby to a detective? Not everyone was sympathetic to a middle-aged man who collected video games for a profession. The detective would be a stranger to his world, would see the stuffed animals, the doodads, his collection of Pac-Man ashtrays and drinking glasses, his Funko Land cartridge sleeves artwork, and probably wonder what his deal was. He imagined himself slipping into the collector's perfectionism of detail, offering an origin story for every single game, but nothing that could ever tell the half of why he'd acquired them. Two officers arrived soon enough and cordoned off the shop in yellow tape. One of them noted in the initial report that Broussard asked, "What do you think about this whole thing?" When the detective got there, he admitted, "Those games were my retirement plan." The police report takes 3 pages to list the titles of every game, monetary values as assigned by Broussard next to each one. Some are misspelled. Chubby Cherub, Winged Baby versus Canines, 1986, Missing It Second U, and the junior cut from the rarest NES original black box game, Donkey Kong Jr., Math, Famous Apes versus an Education, 1986. When Holly Lunsford hears video games, she thinks Nintendo, like someone who hears soda thinks Coke. She thinks Super Mario Brothers, green sewer pipes, pixelated clouds in the vast blue sky, the little mushroom thingy, the Goombas, the death march toward Mario and Luigi. She thinks about playing it with her mother on the basement floor 30 years ago, using a game genie to try to finish World 8. That's the game I grew up on, the detective says now. We also had California games. I like the girl that skates. Broussard had been wrong. Lunsford was not exactly an outsider. She admitted to him that a few years ago, she'd bought a refurbished NES and at age 33 still played her childhood SMB cartridge. Lunsford, with 11 years of law enforcement experience at the time, had brought her tackle box with fingerprint powder and evidence bags, a steno pad for notes. She dusted the back desk and the laundry bag of power tools the perpetrator or perpetrators left behind. She watched Broussard watch her, following her around the store as she worked. None of the prints turned up hits. I know that he spent so long collecting these that it made me feel terrible for him just to have that all wiped out, Lunsford says. If he ever wanted to sell, he'd have a ton of money. She'd never heard of any of the stolen games. Broussard talked her through the list. Chase the Chuck Wagon for the Atari 2600, made by Purina in the early 1980s, only available by mail-in proof of purchase from packages of dog food. Johnson & Johnson's tooth protectors, really just an advertisement for the company's toothbrushes. Captain Novalin, along with the impossible-to-get packaging sleeve, the only Super Nintendo game about living with diabetes. The complete boxed Atari 2600 editions of Bounty Bob Strikes Back, Mutants vs. Landmines, 1984, and Kubert's Cubes, Cussing Orange Creature vs. Snakes, 1983. One of the only dozen or so blue T-handle cartridges of Air Raid known to exist. Bonk's Adventure, Giant-Headed Cave Boy vs. Dinosaurs, 1994, for the NES, Cherry, sealed in the original plastic, certified 9.6 out of 10 by the game grading service WATA, and conceivably worth $100,000 by itself, according to Broussard. I was in awe, Lunsford admits. I didn't know about this stuff. That something would be worth that much in Cherry condition or not, says the detective. But he had it all documented, and there was no reason for me to question it. If I did, I could look it up if I wanted to. And some games I did, like Bubble Bath Babes. That's really one that stuck out in my head. I thought it was a kid game. Apparently, it's Nintendo porn. Lunsford began her investigation with the employees at the store. Tom Spitz, who'd been in Japan during the break-in, and the new guy, Alex Nivad, whom Broussard had hired away from GameStop. Nivad, then 20, was the new dude, words that came out of him in a defeated sigh. As Broussard assured Lunsford, Nivad had been nothing but a diligent employee with a healthy interest in older consoles, some released before he was born. When the store wasn't busy, Broussard taught him how to use the CD buffer to clean used game disc. At first, I was thinking people would point fingers at me, Nivad says, but Jason was totally understanding, and he even joked when I came in the next day, hey, he stole all my games. Broussard learned that Nivad had been sensitive to even this harmless ribbing. I'm the most gullible person you'll ever meet, Nivad said, adding that he didn't know anything about the games in the back. I was like, no, you don't need to look at Alex, Broussard told me, he told Lunsford. I told the detective he's only been here a few weeks, and I don't even think he knows I own a safe. Not long after the theft, Broussard hired Chris Gilbault, a former customer and his friend and confidant, who had an archivist's knowledge of video game history. I spend more time on that than any 35-year-old man should, probably, and the authority to make a deal on his boss's behalf. The theft had forced all four men to start thinking about games in ways that polluted their childhood endearments, in ways they'd either never considered or taken seriously as enthusiasts, as fans. They recognized a new vulnerability in the opportunity someone had taken, and maybe even the personal danger of working at such a store. The customers at Trade and Games offered condolences in the period that followed. They commented with comfort emoji on the Facebook post, Broussard wrote, an emotional description of how his games were gone. They brought him cupcakes and chocolate chip cookies and get-well cards and flowers. They appeared, every so often then, from as far away as Memphis to buy a game, telling him they'd come just wanting to help. Broussard had trouble answering the one question everyone kept asking, how are you doing? The dolly tread and the story had made the local news. The front window got replaced, but Broussard, 46-year-old, the month of the theft, wouldn't come right out and say that he could hardly bear to leave the store or that he slept on an air mattress there for days after the robbery. A few months after the heist, in November, something weirder than usual happened at Grumpy Bob's Emporium, which, like Trade and Games, was one of a dwindling number of used video game stores in the greater Metro St. Louis area. Unlike Trade and Games, it also used to offer lawnmower repair. Only to get to Grumpy Bob's in Maryville, Illinois, a gamer had to cross the Mississippi River. Grumpy Bob's looks like someone's house if they decided to paint the siding bright yellow and the front door blue and put a collage of video game posters on the windows. The mascot is a cartoon portrait of an old man wearing an orange cap and a frown so exaggerated that his lower lip touches his nose and wrinkles his forehead. Grumpy Bob Vogel himself. Mandy Vogel, his daughter-in-law, has helped run the store since Bob passed, and she designed the logo with great affection. Mandy was the one to call Broussard to tell him about the incident at their store, having seen his Facebook post 2 months earlier. On the rainy evening of November 6th, a man and a woman arrived in a beat-up car. The man was wearing a Nike baseball cap, the bill obscuring his face. He held a large fountain soda in his left hand, frustratingly disregarding the sign, asking visitors not to bring food or drink inside. The woman seemed younger, in jeans and some kind of poncho, with a wet grocery bag in her hand. The two of them walked to the register, where the woman opened the bag to reveal some of the rarest games the staff had ever seen, then arranged them on the glass checkout counter, hoping to make a deal. One of the clerks, spidey sense triggered, called the Vogels at home. Mandy came in. The man seemed to get frustrated when Vogel asked them to wait while she checked the prices. She also asked for ID, a result of the sheriff's mandates that anyone who deals in secondhand items with serial numbers provide identification for customers. The man declined to provide any, but the woman showed her driver's license, which said her name was Tanya English. The guy seemed impelled to share a story about the games. He'd had them forever. He found them in the garage and was now trying to see if they had currency. He needed to get his son out of jail. He was fidgety and insistent. How long will this take? Vogel suspected that whoever this was didn't have any knowledge of or love for games at all. Grumpy Bob's had its share of weirdos, and Vogel had trained her staff to be cautious. We've had stalker guys, Vogel says, but 90% of our customers are on the normal side of geek. 10% are very weird, very shifty, though. They're frustrated with pricing. Everything's upsetting to them. They don't want us to do our due diligence. We've always been more than 50% female, and I've had moms reach out to me. Their young gamer girls can go in and talk to them versus these other game stores where it's all guys. When Vogel began to tell this man she didn't have enough cash on hand and couldn't make a deal without knowing his name anyway, he got pissed and began to shout, "I just want my stuff back and we're going to go. This is stupid. We're leaving." They didn't break anything on their way out, which she had feared. The games that Vogel's staffers had still been trying to find trade prices for included a boxed copy of The Flintstones, The Surprise at Dinosaur Peak, The Family You Know versus All of Prehistory, 1994, one of the rarest NES games, worth thousands in good condition, which this one was. Also, Mr. Doe's Castle, Clown versus Unicorns, 1983, for the Atari 2600, still in the box. One of the young women who works at the store noticed Mr. Doe's had a blemish at the top of the box, filled in with red marker, a tiny flaw, one that Broussard had mentioned in his Facebook post. Vogel called Trade and Games the next day, and that was how Holly Lunsford got the first decent security footage of the face of a thief. Broussard thought a better word was crook. In his nightmares, he tried to imagine this person. Who would bring a gas station big gulp into Grumpy Bob's and cause a scene? Who would stuff copies of the rarest games on Earth into a grocery bag and then carry them in the rain? Because Broussard had no cameras outside the store before the robbery, the only recording police had managed to find was security footage from nearby businesses, like Fenton Play and Learn Daycare and Slinger's Restaurant, but nothing solid. Trading Games was barely in view, but around the time of the robbery, a single cab, two-door pickup truck pulls in toward Trading Games from the main road, and, as Lunsford notes, a person approaches the store. But there was still nothing concrete, no hefting the safe into a truck bed, no mid-1980s model Toyota making its getaway. Broussard could only imagine it, which kept him in nocturnal distress. The horrors of someone else with the games, touching, squeezing them, bumping them around. Tonya English and her angry companion operated without inhibition that what they were doing might be suspicious. A few days after their Grumpy Bob's antics, they arrived at Game Over in Union, Missouri, this time perhaps slightly wiser about getting paid. Again, they tried to sell the Flintstones game, rumored and debunked by collectors to have been a rental exclusive at Blockbuster Video. The owner of Game Over, listed in police documents as Matthew Maynard, eventually made a deal. He shelled out cash for Flintstones and also Contra Force, Military versus Terrorist 1992, the rarest and final game in the NES Contra trilogy, both complete in box. But Maynard only spent $450, thousands less than market price. Thousands less than market price. When a Trading Games regular saw the new merch, he recognized those titles. Broussard drove to Game Over to talk to Maynard, who said, according to Broussard, and which Broussard repeated to the police, something to the effect of a little old lady sold him the games from her closet. Lunsford also went to the store and spoke to Maynard, then took the games back to the station. Between the accounts from Grumpy Bob's and Game Over, Lunsford had a decent idea of who she was looking for. English's Facebook page was public and revealed her relationship with a man named Damon Jackson. That man seemed to match the description of a white male who tried to sell games to yet another used game store, a regional chain called Slackers, on more than one occasion at two different stores. In the first incident at the South County Center store, Jackson, partially hidden under a baseball cap, stopped at the threshold of the store's entrance while a female companion, not English, approached the counter, looking over her shoulder at Jackson as though he was her coach. She had so many rare games in her bag, really old games, with the manual and box, that it startled the manager, Matt Ravis. Atari 2600 games like Tapper, Bartender versus Patrons 1983, and Mr. Doe's. No one ever brought in one of those games, much less a purseful. According to Ravis, she said they were her son's games. Ravis offered her a couple $100, a lowball figure she accepted. After she and the man by the door left together, he Googled the name of each game he'd purchased plus St. Louis and eventually found Broussard's Facebook post. Ravis's boss, the owner of Slackers, realized he was in possession of stolen property, and soon Lunsford had taken those games into evidence. By this point, the detective had reclaimed about half of the 120 stolen games. But none of the games could be called Cherry anymore. No, these games had the same titles as the ones Broussard lost, but they had been mauled, or in some cases destroyed, as though the perpetrator realized the only way he could actually sell them without being caught was to cut their value. Broussard's air raid cartridge and his complete inbox Little Samson turned up damaged at two different game stores in Las Vegas, but Broussard didn't get them back. One of the owners told him, "You have insurance, don't involve me, F off," when Broussard called after seeing his games for sale online. Others were more helpful. When it comes to the bigger collections, and when something gets stolen, We collectors are like individual fingers, and when connected, we can form a fist, says John Hancock, a retro game enthusiast with his own significant collection. When something shitty like this happens, collectors work with one another. When Jackson went to establishments closer to home, like Prestige Electronics and Arch City Gaming Company in Bridgeton, Missouri, he didn't bother to disguise himself. And he'd apparently never truly considered the proximity of the stores to each other, or that the owners could possibly know one another. This was no criminal mastermind. He always had some bullshit story, says Broussard. His caper extended in scope, but the lack of creativity ultimately did him in. Jackson drove to Denver in a pickup truck, and the clerk working at Level 7 Games saw it in the parking lot. He told me, "I just had them," says John Young, the Level 7 clerk. He had some crazy rare stuff, like bubble bath babes in the box, games that we'd never seen before, and he didn't give a shit at all. Again, Jackson declined to provide any ID. While Young pretended to look up prices, he had no intention of purchasing any of the games. He told a colleague to take a picture of Jackson's license plate. Young remembered reading about trade and games, and he called Broussard. That was December 13, 2019. Next illustration, rated. Among the collection were Nintendo, Sega, and Atari games. Jackson's story about the games wasn't that unusual, and he told the various clerks that he'd never played them, which rang true, because he didn't know shit about them, says John Merce, the owner of Bodak's Games in St. Louis, another stop on Jackson's list. It didn't flip a switch in my head. It didn't trigger that it was the stuff from Jason's heist. Jackson had a copy of Bobble Part 2, Bob and Bub vs. Skulls, 1993, and a copy of the NES game Worm, Journey to the Center of the Earth, Combat Chick vs. Subterranean Humanoids, 1991, that had also been in the safe. But this one was ripped out of its plastic WATA-graded case. What Mertz didn't know at the time was that Broussard was staking Jackson out. "I paid Jackson in cash," Mertz says. "We posted the games on Facebook, and Jason came in with a police officer and said, 'This stuff is mine.' So when Jackson called Mertz and said he was going to return with more games, this time three undercover agents were waiting, dressed like civilians, idly rifling through Magic, the Gathering cards, and NES cartridges. As Jackson was leaving the counter, the officers descended. He began cursing," Mertz says. "These are mine. I've had them forever. This is effing bullshit. Then I have to go to the bathroom." Jackson clutched his chest when they were putting on handcuffs. The officers had to call an ambulance to the store. Broussard was sitting just outside in his truck, biting his fingernails. Jackson was arrested for possession of stolen property, taken to a local hospital, and released. After the stakeout, Broussard went to the police station with the undercover officers. The men couldn't get over any of it, the ordinary break-in that was also historic and kind of hilarious. And there were NES porn games, really? And so Broussard pulled up videos of Peekaboo Poker on YouTube to show them that it was true. Jackson was arrested again in February 2020 for driving a car with expired plates, and then charged with one count of burglary and three counts of stealing, one for over $25,000, two for amounts over $750. By then, Lunsford had enough evidence to pinpoint him at Trade and Games at the time of the theft, using his phone data from a GPS warrant request. For what is likely the most valuable video game theft in history, Jackson was sentenced to 17 years in prison, deferred on felony probation. Part of his probation agreement depended upon his providing information on the rest of the games and paying around $24,000 in restitution. Charges were never filed against English or the other woman in connection with the case. Broussard used to walk to the back room of the store in the morning just so he could see his games. To behold them was to breathe a little easier. Never mind the paperwork growing on his desk, the bathroom trash can overflowing with wadded-up paper towels, the mini-fridge in need of more Diet Cokes. Walking slowly into the mass of his collection, he could gaze on the colorful spines of the boxes, alphabetized in congruency on shelves that stretched the walls. Nothing else ever made him feel such ambition. The years required, the dedication. How he'd sought to find not only the games, but the ones in the very best condition. He'd brought his fiancée, Hope, to the store one evening, held her hand and took her into the vault. Everything lit up, and he showed me around, and it was overwhelming, says Hope, now his wife. This is how she first understood the pride of the man she was going to marry, the type of collector who'd gone after it all. He showed her ROB, Robotic Operating Buddy, the 1986 NES robot console, and its sought-after box. Esoterica, like a clean copy of the Outback Joey exercise game for the Genesis, Kangaroo vs. Calories, 1993, and his Cherry Rampage 2 Universal Tour for Nintendo 64, Giant Animals vs. Buildings, 1999, that came with a plush rat keychain. He drove her to Tennessee to pick up an Atari 2600 mall kiosk from the late 1970s, to conventions like the Midwest Gaming Classic in Wisconsin. He knew all the vendors and toured her through the booths full of games. When he asked her to marry him, and she said yes, his friend presented them with a custom NES painted bridal white, with his and hers controllers. Did she know about the games in the safe? Duh. Cheetah Man 2, Final Fight Guy, Hagan for Super Nintendo. Not only his work, but his life's work. His life's work, which had become a part of her own. Their kids from different marriages played at the store at home. After he received some of the stolen games from police evidence in three batches, the last of which had come in a Huggies box, he set them out on the table with a white photo backdrop, where he usually took pictures of the store's games before putting them online to sell, so he could see them better. The copy of Tapper that had been sold to Slackers, Cherry in the safe, looked like a car had backed over it. Stuntman, Guy vs. Laws of Physics, 1983, a rare game by the Panda Company, and Quadroon, Runts vs. Captors, 1983. Jackson had unsealed those from the ancient factory shrink wrap. The Atari 2600 game Boing, Bubble vs. Squares, 1983, complete in box, was now flattened, the cardboard furrowed. His copy of Guardian, Planet vs. Ship, 1982, gashed where an old price sticker had been on the top right, untouched from whoever purchased it long ago. Jackson had eradicated the serial numbers off the Panesian porn trinity, Bubble Bath Babes, Bubbles vs. Gravity plus a Naked Woman, Hot Slots, Slot Machine vs. Lust plus, eventually, a Naked Woman, Peekaboo Poker, The Hand You're Dealt vs. a Naked Woman's, with what Broussard imagined had to be steel wool or a belt sander. He's still trying to get back to where he was before, says Hope. It's like looking at a piece of art for him. You wouldn't want to see a Picasso have a scratch on it. And basically, that's how I would describe these to him, as his Picasso. I'd rather not have them back at all, he told Hope. Broussard hid the list of the games he'd made for insurance, $92,000 in the end, at the bottom of a drawer. He placed the Huggies box with about 40 of the games he'd gotten back on the floor of the vault room, away from view. Broussard has thought about trying to market his tragedy, he confesses. Even damaged, maybe they have value. The heist aftermath coincided with the pandemic. 2 years of having way too much time by himself to obsess about it. He created a world of games to exist everywhere he could set his eyes, and now, in lockdown, he was constantly trying to avert them. He had never collected for money. He wanted to own the games as a grown-up, because he played them as a child. But money was one of the only things he saw now when he went into the back room. How could he see anything else? It at least quantified his emotional loss. He sat down at his desk and wrote about how much he thought his entire collection would bring. $2 million? Three? Maybe it's time to sell, he said to Gilbalt. The first video game Broussard ever got was called Megamania, Spaceship vs. Hamburgers, 1982, for the Atari 2600. It was a Christmas present, the year he was 10. He'd torn the cartridge out of the box, forever diminishing the game's value, of course not knowing the collector he'd become. Then, the rudimentary piece of media impressed upon him the vaguest notion of his future life. Games would turn out to be connections to the past, to iterations of himself at different points. The 20-something who toted around a Nintendo 64, working for a plane cleaning company. The dad playing Wii with his daughter and son, who would grow up hanging around at the store. People remember doing certain things with friends and family, he says. I think that's what video games do, and that's what makes them what they are. The first game he purchased on eBay to start his collection, back in his early 20s, was Megamania Cherry for $10. When Broussard left Missouri this past fall and moved to Florida, he didn't take that game with him, or any of the others. He couldn't find the energy to alphabetically display cartridges on the walls of the new condo. There's not a single game visible in the place. He still owns trading games, but Gilbalt has the keys. It's a sort of semi-retirement, Broussard jokes. He's got a job in gaming at a company called CGC that has made its name in comics and coins. And he'll spearhead the public launch of its game grading arm late this year. He and Hope are car enthusiasts, and so they drive their Jeep to car shows and to the flea market in Fort Myers. Someone manning a retro game booth even recognized him once. Aren't you the guy from the robbery? That was the iteration of Broussard now, the collector who had his favorite prizes stolen, the mother of all game collections. In the safe, he was now just trying to forget. Crown Jewel, Aznawi and the Woman King, Tusomebedu channels the power of an Agoji warrior, by Britt Hinemuth. Tusomebedu broke hearts and raked in accolades as Cora in Barry Jenkins' limited series The Underground Railroad, based on Colson Whitehead's book. Now, the rising South African star makes her big screen debut in Gina Prince Bythewood's historical drama The Woman King, opposite Viola Davis. Being surrounded by such strong, fierce women, she smiles and pauses, "I am looking forward to the next press tour." Born in KwaZulu-Natal, the land of the Zulus, she's the first artist in her family because my parents were born during the apartheid era. My mother wanted to be a geologist, but she wasn't allowed. She lost her mother young, so Mebedu's grandmother raised her and her sister. My grand passed 3 days before my on-screen debut. After graduating from drama school in Johannesburg, I couldn't afford to fail and go back home. It was not an option. Her big break came in the form of the series Isithunzi. I hadn't worked for 6 straight months. I'd gone through depression as a result. I was like, if I don't get this one, take me, Jesus. She laughs. I'm dramatic. After 2 consecutive International Emmy nominations, she auditioned for The Underground Railroad. At her final callback, she cried so much her contact lens flipped inside out. I hope they don't want another take, she thought. I practically ran out. Years later, the newfound Angelino and Jenkins remain close. I bother him at random times. I invite myself to use the pool. I don't even need you to be at the house. She turned down a major franchise. Which one? I can't say. To do The Woman King. The film has an all-star cast, which Mebedu says are all introverts, except for John Boyega, who is a complete clown and a joy to work with. She and Davis formed a particular bond. Viola did say that if her story was turned into a biopic, she would love me to play her, I said. I can audition? And she said, no, Tuso can play. I said, oh. Now, she's producing with a deal at Paramount Plus to make socially conscious content. I want to create opportunities for other people, and I'm grateful I'm able to. Due time. Black filmmakers star in a new exhibit at LA's Academy Museum by Johanna Desta. In the photo, the Nicholas brothers in a scene from Stormy Weather, 1943. When visitors step into regeneration black cinema, 1898 to 1971, they will see rare objects like Lena Horne's gown from Stormy Weather. Clips from buried blaxploitation films like Black Chariot and home movies from the likes of Cab Calloway. From the onset, there has been black participation in cinema, co-curator Ray Combs says. The show has been 5 years in the making, says co-curator Doris Berger. Along the way, shaped by advisors like Ava DuVernay and influenced by research trips to the south of France, where the curators visited Josephine Baker's preserved castle. Regeneration was sparked by the historic 2017 rediscovery of Something Good, Negro Kiss, a short clip from 1898 depicting two black actors tenderly kissing, which will show beside Glenn Ligon's Double America II neon work to create a dialogue between historic and contemporary black art. The past stepping into its rightful place in the present. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.